You're listening to Opera Box Score.
Let's get ready to rumble!
Wherever you are, however you're listening, it's America's talk radio show about opera. It's Opera Box Score. I'm Weston Williams, joined by Oliver Camacho and Matt Cummings. All right, this week we go inside the huddle with an icon of American opera and early music and cabaret. It's, I can't believe we got her, Sylvia McNair.
Yay!
Then in the two-minute drill, we'll unpack Lyric Opera of Chicago's hot off the presses 24-25 season announcement and catch you up on the latest open letters to Arts Council England. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, click follow on Apple Podcasts, hit the plus sign, send us a voice memo or email us your hot takes at mailbag@operaboxscore.com, or just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. However you contribute, you'll get an OBS beer coaster, an OBS lapel pin, and a number one OBS fan foam finger just for sharing your own hot takes. And fellas, I am back in the States after a lovely week overseas in the birthplace of opera. I was in Venice. I was in Frankfurt, sun-kissed by that beautiful Frankfurt sun. Oliver Camacho, are you feeling sun-kissed today?
Really? Is it sunny in Frankfurt? I thought it was like the Gary, Indiana of Europe.
How could you possibly say that when they have won the 2023 Opera House of the Year? And I did see Der Traumgürge there, so I was a very happy boy.
Did you drag your wife to that too?
She actually loved it.
She loved it. I also saw in Venice, I saw Maria Egizikaya or Egiziaka. I don't even know how to pronounce it because the super titles
These are all made up.
This was an Ottorino Respighi opera that I watched without English super titles. I can't tell you what was in it, but it was great. Matt Cummings, how have you been?
Oh, you know, making the rounds. I've been hiding.
He really has. This has been a really great sort of break for me, but I really don't know what's going on in sports. So if either of you could help me with that, that'd be ideal.
Well, I know that Novak Djokovic was just eliminated by an Italian player named Nardi. I know so little about Luca Nardi in the, I believe, third round of the Indian Wells Masters, which is shocking. You know, it's a hard court Masters, and it doesn't bode well for Djokovic's season, which makes me very excited.
And that's what I tune into Opera Box Score for, is the tennis updates. But Matt Cummings, do you have any sports for me at all?
I mean, since the Olympics are still several months away, I'm just Googling sports to see if I can find anything interesting.
That's the level of professionalism you've come to expect from our amazing cadre of hosts here. Let's talk some opera.
Huddle up. Let's go inside the huddle.
I cannot believe that Sylvia McNair, agreed to be interviewed on WFMT, but also stuck around for an additional 20 minutes to talk to me.
Amazing.
On Opera Box Score. My interview with Sylvia McNair will air on Saturday, March 16th on WFMT, and will be available to stream for 14 days after that. And I just have to say that my sort of taste in vocal music sort of perfectly aligns with what Sylvia McNair was doing in the 90s, because at the start of her recording career, she was doing, you know, Mozart and Handel. Then she, at least for the 90s, went into a deep cut for the repertoire by recording an all Purcell album, which won her a Grammy Award. And she told me the story off mic that that album wasn't even something that Philips, her label at the time, wanted to do. She had to convince them that it was a good idea, and it won the Grammy, because that's how unpopular early music was back in the 90s.
Only 90s kids will remember.
Then mid-90s, she started to pivot towards the American songbook, and she recorded two albums, which I still listen to, or I still put on at dinner parties. One of Harold Arlen songs and the other of Jerome Kern. And then she recorded Popea with John Edward Gardner. I know that's not a name we like to talk about that much. But so all of this to say that I'm not much of a jazz person, but her album of Jerome Kern introduced me to some of this American songbook stuff. And her interest in Monteverdi and her recording that Popea almost perfectly aligns with my interest in that opera. And, you know, deeper into the early Baroque. And her interest in high Baroque music, Purcell, also aligns with mine. And like, I think she did it so well, and nobody else was really doing it for as large of a public as she had because of who she was. And of course, there had always been like the early music specialists who were doing it. But, you know, somebody with a major contract, you know, Philips deciding to devote one of their solo albums to the music of Purcell was definitely a risk back in the 90s. So what do we love Sibyl McNair for? It's, to me, her seemingly perfect voice, like always in tune, rhythmically accurate, language that's very, very clear, and a tone that has no noise in it, but still feels feminine and human. It wasn't necessarily a straight tone, but it definitely had an austerity and a purity to it that made it perfect. So for so much 17th and 18th century music. So I do ask her immediately up front about this idea of perfection. But before we hear that part of the conversation, let's just listen to a little bit of Devieni Non Tardar from her recording made with the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, conducted by Sir Neville Mariner. I want to touch back on something we talked about for my radio show, which is this idea of perfection in singing. And yeah, I have to say that like listening to your work can be very intimidating, I think, for young singers. And I think a lot of, you know, people wanted to imitate your sound and maybe got themselves into some trouble because of how on recording, especially in your, you know, Baroque and Mozart recordings, it sounds like pristine, you know, like we listen to your Ed Incarnatus Est. And we know that that thing is just like a vocalese. And your scales and your intonation and the staccati and the ability to turn on the trill, you made it sound so easy. Is there something you'd like to say to those singers who might have heard you and like are still influenced by what you did about achieving that level of, you know, note perfect?
Okay, first of all, there's no such thing as perfect. Perfect doesn't exist. When I listen to some of those recordings that you're referencing, I hear so many flaws, Oliver. I hear so many things I wish I'd had a chance to do better. So if perfect doesn't exist, what do we aim for? Excellence. When I can aim for excellence, when I can aim for doing my best on a given day, at a given hour, when they turn on the microphone, that's really all I've got, because I know it's not going to be perfect. Those would be my comments about striving for perfection. Don't, because it's frustrating, but do strive for your very, very best, your own personal best. Of course, that's a worthwhile endeavor. What was the second thing I was going to say?
I mean, like you were.
Oh, I know what it was. Okay. So this is okay. Here's something else I'd like to say. That is, don't copy anybody else. If people listen to my recordings and appreciate something about them, I'm really, really honored by that. But the truth of the matter is, every singer needs to be him or herself, to be true to their own sound and not copy someone. I got myself into terrible vocal trouble at one point in my life, trying to copy somebody else's sound. It was a teacher, and there were reasons for that choice, but it was not the right choice for me. So finding your own voice, and frankly, finding coaches and teachers who will help you find your own voice rather than trying to get you to replicate someone else's sound. That's what you need to be doing.
Now that you've retired from teaching, do you look back at your teaching career fondly? And do you have, did you have students who came to you like I'm coming to you today, like just, you know, drop down at your feet like you're my queen, like please teach me everything you know?
I had some students in my 10 years of teaching on the faculty at the Jacobs School of Music at Indiana University who will be my friends for life. I've even put a lot of them in my will. That's true. Because we have developed relationships, friendships beyond teacher-student relationships since I retired from the faculty. And I am in contact with at least a dozen of them, certainly monthly, sometimes weekly. Working with young singers was far and away the best part of 10 years on a faculty. I was on a wonderful faculty at a school that is very big, very well known for its size, and certainly a lot of activities going on. I came to academia sort of after 25 years, a quarter of a century in the real world, as we call it, capital T, capital R, capital W. And it was a difficult transition for me to suddenly have to figure out how to navigate academia. I'm not sure I did that part very successfully, but when it comes to the students, that was my great joy. I taught some classes. I actually taught a class called English Diction for Singers, where I taught the International Phonetic Alphabet. That meant I had to learn the International Phonetic Alphabet. Well, I'd been working with the IPA for many, many years, but I really had to learn it in a way that I was worthy of teaching it. So that was a great experience. And I loved those hours with the young singers in the English Diction for Singers class. Absolutely loved that. I also taught an opera workshop in which we did a lot of musical theater. And I renamed the class Performance Workshop because I wanted students to get better at more things. In this day and age, if you're going to be employed as a singer, you got to be able to do it all, not just, you know, focus in on one aspect of singing, not just focusing on classical music. It's still what a lot of people teach. But I actually think the more things you can do and do well, the better your chances are of being gainfully employed.
I'm so glad to hear that you have that philosophy. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that your musicianship is very high. Your musical skill is at a very high level, and we know that's because you started as an instrumentalist. But, you know, listening to your recordings of 17th and 18th century music, before, you know, there was this explosion of, you know, quote unquote opera singers, you know, breaking into the period instrument movement, you were doing it. And I just, you're somebody who is like on the forefront of this movement. And now it seems like everybody has to do their Handel album, has to do their, you know, their Seicento album. And what was it like to be an American in, you know, the 90s who was getting a lot of work in this movement when it was mostly Europeans that were doing it?
I didn't really have to actively break into anything, Oliver. I really just walked through the doors that opened for me. My voice is not a great big huge operatic voice by American standards. I don't sing, you know, Verdi and Puccini and Wagner and all that big big rep. My voice was much better suited to 17th and 18th century music. And honestly, the European piece of my career was far and away the larger. I was in Europe 6 to 9 months of every year for many, many years, 12 to 15 years, I'd say, because that was where I fit. I had a great manager there who, you know, made things happen. I'm not sure that kind of management exists anymore, but in the late 80s and 90s and the early O's, that's where the work was for me, the work that fit me and the work that I fit. So that's where I spent my time singing, but I don't really feel like I was breaking any boundaries. I was just working a lot with John Elliott Gardner and, you know, Chris Hogwood, and those people were the leaders, the true leaders in this so-called early music movement, the original instruments period. Chris has passed away, but John Elliott Gardner is still going strong.
There is the American approach to teaching singing, which tends to make everything international, where, you know, we're basically, it's the foundation is the bel canto technique. And if you're, quote unquote, like a good singer, like you have height and all the vowels, you know, the tone is even top to bottom, you can have a healthy projection, and you sacrifice, you know, style, you sacrifice specific vowels for different languages. You don't sing off the breath ever. Maybe your phrasing is a little bit more generic as opposed to looking for those shorter phrases with more gestural phrases. And so when I listen to your 17th and 18th century music, it's like you have a very healthy sound, but yet you're going for these, you know, things that signal to people who are like nerdy about this music, oh, she's doing all of that too, and she's singing healthy. Does that make sense now, what I'm saying?
Well, you're smarter than I am. Because I certainly followed everything you said, but I'm absolutely certain I was not thinking all of that while I was doing it. I will say this, going back to having been trained as a violinist all those years and years and years, 17th and 18th century music, for the most part, if you put your thumb over the words, The melody you're looking at is an instrumental melody. It's the same as the oboe player or the flute player has or the violin player has or the cello player has. It's an instrumental line, but then with words underneath. So I have always assumed that my success, such as it was in 17th and 18th century rep, had as much to do with approaching it as a violinist. And then, oh yeah, putting the words in too. So words have always mattered so much to me. And I'll tell you a story, speaking of Handel, I'll tell you a story that goes right along with that. When I was doing the role of Cleopatra in Handel's opera, Julius Caesar, I was more interested in Cleopatra, the historical person, and I wanted to know more about her story and her life than the role in the Handel opera gave me the opportunity to run with. Handel opera, like Bel Canto opera, is all about showing off the voice. That's what makes it work or not. How well can you show off all the things your voice can do? How fast are your melismas? How fancy are your ornaments? How masterful are your trills? How great is your pitch? How soft is your soft? How loud is your loud? All those vocal gymnastics, the Olympics for the voice, I sometimes call it. How well can you show off all of those things? Well, okay, fine, but it doesn't really, really give you a chance to delve into a story or a character quite as much as I was always interested in doing. So I'm glad that you think I have great musicianship and intonation and agility. I'm really, really glad you feel that way. Intonation has always been, you know, a very high priority for me, and that definitely has its roots in playing the violin.
Your interest in language, I think, comes across very well in the back half of your career, especially the recordings you made with André Previn and David Finck. But you did record this album of Melody with Roger Vignol that I love so much. And we're going to finish today listening to Spleen, which is like not really like a show closer per se, but I just want the audience to hear just like the spectrum of what you just said. Like, this song is very quiet, it's very intimate, but then there's like this gut punch line at the end, and you pull the trigger. And in your classical era recordings, we don't often hear you go for that tone quality, like something that feels very, for lack of a better word, full-throated and hurt. And I remember hearing this for the first time. I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't know she could make a sound like that. Do you remember that song, Spleen, from Ariette Ubile? I know it's been a while since she probably sang that.
You think?
Yeah.
Now you have me curious. I'm going to have to go get that disc out of a box, which is buried in a corner of a closet.
It's probably on your computer somewhere. Just like go to Spotify.
Put it on the CD player and try to figure out what you're talking about. I will say, again, singing these chansons, they were the natural stepping stone to move into doing cabaret, because French songs are salon songs. They're very intimate. They're very, as John Corigliano used to say to me about my microphone technique, Sylvia, you have a for your ears only kind of sound on the mic. Well, I take that as a great compliment because, again, the microphone increased my choices for expression. Now, that the microphone came into play in the songbook, in the American songbook rep, not in the French rep. In the French repertoire, you know, you're singing acoustically, you're singing naturally, but very much pulled back. You cannot sing song rep, whether it's leader or chanson or Spanish songs or songs in English, classical songs in English. You cannot sing them like they're opera arias. You have to pull it in and make it a much more for your ears only kind of sound.
Well, I've kept you for long enough. Sylvia McNair, thank you for joining us on Opera Box Score.
It has been my extreme pleasure, Oliver. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Another recording of hers that I've always loved is the complete recording of the Britten Midsummer Night's Dream that she made with the London Symphony Orchestra in 1996. I know Brian Asawa is the Oberon on that.
Yeah.
But just like the clarity of her tone and the just like transparency with which she's able to sing really, really works in new music as well. I mean, that's not like, that wasn't like brand new music in the 90s, but there's some weird moments in that Midsummer Night's Dream, and especially for Titania, where they just have to, she is totally able to float all those gossamer lines and just sound completely otherworldly, which is both sonically beautiful and also like very much the character of the opera.
Well, we spent a lot of time on WFMT talking about her And True Love, which she recorded under Seiji Ozawa with Anthony Rolfe Johnson as Tom Rakewell and Jane Henschel as Baba the Turk. So you'll have to tune into that interview to hear us talk about And True Love. But in between the interview, you heard selections from that recording of Popea made with the English Baroque soloists, and let's just call them J.E.G. you also heard a little bit of Da Tempeste from her Metropolitan Opera performance of Giulio Cesare, conducted by John Nelson. And that last clip, as I had set up in the interview, from her album of French Melodies, the song Spleen by Debussy with pianist Roger Vignoles.
Make sure you send us a voice memo or email us your hot takes on the perfection of the voice. mailbag@operaboxscore.com, or you can just record your thoughts using the You Got Something to Say tab on our website, operaboxscore.com. It's the 2-minute drill.
This just in. The 2-minute drill.
All right, listen up. Here's everything you need to know about what happened in Opera Land this week.
Earlier today, Lyric Opera of Chicago announced its 2024-25 season. We'll break it down after the drill.
LA Opera's social media team is in hot water after an Instagram post on International Women's Day comparing various production photos with aspects of the menstrual cycle. The company deleted the post and issued an apology, saying, "Our timing was off by connecting the post with International Women's Day, a day when we should be instead celebrating our many accomplishments and contributions. We apologize."
The Metropolitan Opera added a production note on its website for its current run of Turandot that has caught the attention of that anti-woke side of the media. The note in question says, quote, "Turandot draws on other cultures, as Puccini had done throughout much of his career, yet it is in no way authentically Chinese either. A Western projection of the East, it is rife with contradictions, distortions, and racial stereotypes, and yet is also one of the most exhilarating and impressive works ever to take the operatic stage." The New York Post decried the note as a, quote, "woke trigger warning full of," quote again, "manufactured racial exasperation."
Just before the curtain rose on an opera ballet at La Scala, principal dancer Roberto Bolle, general manager Dominique Meyer, and other members of the dance company, orchestra, and stage crew revealed a banner reading, "Cease Fire." The audience responded with a standing ovation lasting over 2 minutes.
It has been a bad couple of weeks for Wagner. Theater Erfurt in Germany has canceled their ring cycle amid financial difficulties, opting instead to produce the more financially responsible oratorio Elijah. The cancellation comes after general director Guy Montavon was put on leave over alleged sexual harassment, and musical director Alexander Pryor resigned suddenly in December. Meanwhile, Virginia Opera has switched out its upcoming Götterdämmerung for a cheaper production, Don Giovanni, in a much less Western-enticing start to their 50th season.
In an open letter, Welsh National Opera addressed the ongoing fallout of ACE's defunding of their company. Quote, "The funding WNO receives jointly from both the Arts Council England and Arts Council of Wales enables the company to work at the highest level of excellence locally, nationally, and internationally," said WNO music director Tomáš Hanus. "It is comparable to asking a Premier League football team to play and win matches with six players instead of 11.
The Chicago Symphony Orchestra has received a $21 million gift from the Negaunee Foundation. It's one of the largest gifts in the company's history. CSO President Jeff Alexander expressed gratitude, quote, "for this exceptional generosity and vision that will sustain our inspiring and effective programs well into the future."
Dallas Opera has announced the winners of its national vocal competition. First place went to Armenian baritone Navasard Hakobian, who sang Enrico's aria and cabaletta from Lucia di Lammermoor. Second prize went to bass baritone Jongwon Hon, and third was a tie between sopranos Elisa Sunshine and Katarina Burton. The Jonathan Pell People's Choice Award went to mezzo Lisa Marie Rogali.
Vittorio Grigolo will perform this spring in Moscow's Zariade Hall. The recital in May marks the second time the tenor has performed in Russia since the country's invasion of Ukraine, in stark contrast to most other Western singers.
In trade news, Palm Beach Opera's general director David Walker is stepping down. The Grange Festival has tapped Tyler Stoops as their new CEO, and La Scala has appointed 63-year-old Fortunato Ortombina, the world's most Italianly named man, to be its new general director.
Exit stage right, French conductor Paul Vermel has died just 5 days before his 100th birthday. In addition to a broad and varied symphonic career, Vermel was also music director of the summer opera program at Green Mansions in the Berkshires.
Polish baritone Marcin Bronikowski has died at the age of 55. He was the recipient of a number of international singing awards, including a distinction at the 1993 Cardiff Singer of the World competition. And he went on to work closely with Polish National Opera, as well as making a number of recordings.
And on this day, we're recording March 12th, in 1710, it was the birth of English composer Thomas Arne in London. In 1726, the first performance of Handel's Scipione, also in London. Gaspare Spontini had a first performance of his opera Julie, or The Pot of Flowers, in Paris in 1805 at the Opera Comique. Soprano Sofia Cruvelli was born in 1826. She created the role of Hélène in Verdi's Vespri Siciliani. And in 1840, Saverio Mercadante's La Solitaria delle Asturie, or Spain Recuperated, or Spain Recovered, premiered in Venice at La Fenice. In 1857, Simone Boccanegra premiered in Venice. That's an opera by Verdi, by the way. Don't mean to assume you knew that.
The first version.
a tenor named Eduardo Garbin was born in 1865. He created the role of Fenton in Verdi's Falstaff and Milio Dufresne in Leoncavallo's Zaza. In 1888, German conductor Hans Knappertsbusch was born. 1905 saw the first performance of Ottorino Respighi's Re Enzo. And on this day, March 12th, in 1954, it was the first performance of Arnold Schoenberg's Moses and Aaron.
The best day of the year. That's your 2-minute drill.
That was not from Moses and Aaron, but it was from Thomas Arne's opera that people apparently have heard of, Artaxerxes. That was, of course, Dame Joan Sutherland from her album, The Art of the Prima Donna. I believe it's the first track on that album.
Yeah.
Really opening with a bang there.
So I was at the Lyric Opera press event, and by the time this episode drops, it will be widely known what's going on over there. But we do have the scoop. It's 6 shows plus Sandra Radwanovsky in concert singing an aria from every Puccini opera. So 11 arias in total with the orchestra. Patti LuPone is going to do a gala event, and the orchestra and chorus are going to do some season finale. Who knows what it's going to be? The repertoire is not announced. But the 6 shows, 4 of them in the fall and then the last 2 in the spring. They open with Rigoletto, starring Javier Camarena and Manet Galoyan. I think that's how you say her name. Manet is also singing at Santa Fe this year as La Traviata, as Violetta. Igor Golovatenko is Rigoletto in this. This is an old production or a revival production. Great. You know, I mean, I've always said that Rigoletto is a great first opera. And I think it's a better season opener than, let's say, Hernani.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you get butts and seats with Rigoletto.
So Matthew Ozawa was a part of this season announcement, and he sort of frames the 6 operas as pairs of operas, one traditional and one contemporary. And the contemporary pair for Rigoletto is his production of Fidelio. Okay. Not such a contemporary opera, but, you know, the production is going to be a modern Ozawa joint, and there are production images of it already. It's premiered in San Francisco. There's, an aluminum fence as part of the set design.
Ooh.
And I feel like the aluminum fencing is like in every production of opera.
Is it going to turn out to be a bed frame? You'll find out. Call back to Yennefer for all my Yennefer heads out there.
So Fidelio stars Elsa Vandenhever as Leonora and Russell Thomas, friend of the show, as Florestan. Moving on to the second pair of operas, Marriage of Figaro, starring friend of the show Ying Fang as Susanna, with Frederica Lombardi.
That's incredible casting.
Frederica Lombardi as Countess Emma Viva, and she was so good in that Don Giovanni with Ivo Van Hove from the Met. I am very much looking forward to hearing her in person. Kaylee Decker, Ryan Opera Center alumna, sings Cherubino. And the Figaro, I don't know, Peter Kellner. And the Count, I also don't know, Gordon Bintner. Looking forward to learning more about those singers. This is the Barbara Gaines production. Barbara Gaines is well known in the Chicago theater community. I don't know what her reputation is like outside of Chicago, but she is...
She's the queen of Chicago Shakespeare Theater for a long time.
Yes. So the pair for Marriage of Figaro is Janine Tesori and Tazewell Thompson's Blue, which are finally getting here in Chicago, starring Zoe Reams as the mother, Kenneth Kellogg as the father, and Norman Garrett as the reverend. For me, Blue seems like it's a chamber opera, so I haven't seen it yet. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But one good thing is that it is introducing a woman of color composer to lyrics heretofore hasn't had a woman composer represented in their repertoire. So that's exciting. Then they take their winter break. And when they come back, it's the Radvanovsky concert. And then we go into the spring portion of their season, beginning with La Boheme, with actually a pretty baller cast. Eileen Perez and Pene Pati as Mimi and Rodolfo, Gabriela Reyes and Will Liverman as Musetta and Marcello. So I'm
OBS okay man that. Of that's, the year for 2023.
That's true.
Yes. And that's a new to Chicago production from LA and Dallas. Then the season finale is Missy Mazzoli's and Rice Fabric's The Listeners, starring Nicole Heaston, Kyle Kettleson, friend of the show, Jasmine Habersham, Jonas Hacker, and friend of the show, Daniela Mack. So I don't know anything about the show. I have the description of it. But, you know, we stand Missy Mazzoli.
True.
This is a co-production with Norwegian National Opera and Opera Philadelphia. So before we started recording, we were talking about the trend at Lyric Opera. If you remember back at the 2021 season, they had seven operas on the slate, one of which was Proving Up, the Missy Mazzoli joint. But that show got canceled. So in the end, it ended up being six shows.
Yeah.
And the 2022 season, they had Fiddler on the Roof as one of the shows. So if you subtract Fiddler on the Roof, they also only had six shows. So in a way, it is maintaining the status quo. Just no announcement of a music theater piece in this season so far. But we do get a Patti LuPone concert, so maybe that fits that slot.
And she is related to Adelina Patti, after all. So really, it's just the continuation of opera.
I'm personally not mad at this season. I mean, of course, I always want to hear a Baroque opera. But I know that we are in this, like, trying to manage loss, loss of audience. And I think that, you know, adding a Rigoletto and a Boheme to your season is, it feels like an emergency, you know? But I think they're doing smart things with it. Like with the cast of Boheme is very, you know, BIPOC forward. Rigoletto has Javier Camarena. So for Chicago audiences, he already has established his brand here, having done two concerts at the Harris Theater and a partnership with the Mexican Museum of Art. I forget what that place is called. So he's cultivated his Mexican following here in Chicago.
And he's an outstanding singer. I mean, that's a great opportunity.
So Blue and The Listeners are for the, you know, attracting new audiences. And Anthony Freud says that he saw Blue in Oslo, or Matthew Ozawa saw it in Oslo. One of them saw it. And, Enrique Mazzola was the person who saw it. And he said he was really delighted with how many young people showed up to The Listeners. I mean, it's Norway, so I think just people look younger there in general.
it's all that volcanic steam. I think that this season feels very much like an experiment to me. I know it's like this, the companion pieces, you know, I think they're almost trying to see if there can be any crossover between the audiences, between the new and the extremely traditional operas. Again, before we were recording, Matt made the observation that there's new stuff and there's old stuff, but there's nothing in between, you know, there's nothing like, there's no challenging older opera, right?
There's no 20th century opera.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no French opera. There's no, like, it's either like top 20 operas, greatest hits, chestnuts, brand new, or a new production of Fidelio. Like, I would love personally for me, like, a season that's a little bit more balanced in terms of like what they are offering. I definitely think, Oliver, you're onto something that they are, they have counterbalancing in mind. And I think that that comes through very clearly in this programming, that it is either like absolute crowd pleasers or it's like something you've never heard before.
Yeah. Where is your Moses and Aaron?
Yeah. Where's my Moses and Aaron? Like they're too cowardly to put that one on, but like, you know, I want something a little bit spicier. Cause there's, you know, like there is a market for it. I feel like American companies have really convinced themselves that there's no way to do something like that. But
well, in related trade news, they also announced that Enrique Mazzola will extend his role of music director to the 2030-31 season. That's a bonus 5 years onto his existing contract. And there is still no successor named for CEO and general director Anthony Freud as of now.
So if you're listening, Lyric Opera Chicago, we're all available here. Let's move on to, I think I can think of no other subject more worthy to be talked about by three men than this LA Opera social media flub here.
When this post came out, I saw it. I was like, what is this? This is so weird. And then this group that I'm in, a Facebook group, screenshotted it and shared it. And I'm glad that they did, because the LA Opera quickly took it down and issued this mealy-mouthed apology about the timing was off. The post itself, there's nothing wrong with
the
post.
And the first comment on the post that you can see on the in some of the stories covering it is friend of the show Laura Dixon Strickling just saying, rethink posting this.
This is such a strange post. You know, I have a lot of sympathy for opera companies doing social media because, you know, it's hard. You got to really be on the have your finger on the pulse. You got to, you know, really be following trends and putting stuff out there. This one was bad. You know, the conservative sexist didn't like it because it talked about icky menstrual cycles. The progressives didn't like it because it had a aggressive sort of cis normativity to the whole thing. And the normies were just kind of weirded out by the whole thing. And, you know, this was such a mess. Like every single classical music group I am on the internet found this post and tore it to shreds in every way you could possibly find. And oh man, I don't think, and then the apology also has been torn to shreds by various groups in various ways too. So this was just a mess. It was something to see, you know, it was a unifying moment for the internet. Speaking of divisive content, let's talk about the New York Post and how much they suck as a paper.
Talk about a tempest in a teapot. Like, oh my God.
Oh God.
Do people still say that?
So this is one of those things that, you know, the Met posted on its website this production note, a very thoughtfully written piece about the problems with the libretto from a 21st century lens.
It is like the most anodyne, factual, even-handed presentation of these facts possible about, like, here are all of the inspirations that Puccini drew from for these Chinese melodies that you hear as, like, one of his melodic and orchestral colors throughout the score. Here are some of the sources of the mist that he drew on. Here are some quotes from some Chinese scholars about why they find work, like, maybe not the best, but no one is, like, screaming for the work to not be performed. Like, that is just absolute projection from these people at the New York Post who don't even want that to be, they don't even want, like, facts about the opera to be talked about because it freaks them out.
Well, I think what happened was someone at the New York Post was looking for something to write about that had a catchy headline. And they probably came across an article by enemy of the show, Norm Lebrecht, on Slip Disc or something, talking about how this was a trigger warning and, you know, this bowing to woke culture or whatever, and decided to make a whole article out of it. And, you know, it's just a good reminder, folks, if you're reading something in the New York Post, please, please do some fact checking before you form any opinions on that subject.
No, Weston, they quoted an 88-year-old soprano who said that she thought it was silly. So, like, what more is there to be said?
Well, I mean, you know, I guess they win. I want to talk about the open letter because, you know, it's I feel like it's so infrequent now that we see Matt, you know, and I just want him. I'm so glad he came back for this episode.
Did you get them to write an open letter just to bring me back onto the show, Matt?
Just for you. Now, I think this is, you know, we've been talking about this, you know, this whole defunding debacle for months now. But, you know, there's some, you know, I don't know about you, Matt, but I have hope now. You know, it's an open letter. How could it not convince Arts Council?
I'll tell you how they can get more money. They should get money from the Kensington Palace social media team. All of that budget should be redirected to Arts Council England. Exclusively for posts about Kate Middleton going to see different operas.
But isn't she missing right now? Isn't there like some conspiracy?
She sure
that
is.
She's dead or something? That's true.
You know,
doesn't mean they can't post about it.
It's been a while.
Buyer beware. Caveat emptor.
Yeah, so true. Oliver Camacho, what do you have for me from the 2 minute drill this week?
The ceasefire obviously is, I think it's a strong statement. And I feel like we're going to start to see maybe more of that stuff. It's really tricky to talk about this and to not sound anti-Semitic or to sound anti-Muslim. It's very, very complicated. So I appreciate when, people do make political statements at arts events. And this is, to me, the right way to do it, as opposed to that environmental organization that scared everybody and people are like running for the exits with their protest.
I will say a pretty shockingly different response described in this article compared to like Jonathan Glazer's speech at the Oscars, which talk about the bad faith anti-woke machine in the media, like cutting the second half of his sentence off and pretending that he said that he was disowning his Jewishness when he was saying, I don't like my Jewishness being used to defend what is being done to Palestinians in Gaza. Like, and kind of the tepid response that speech got in the room at the Oscars. Like, just interesting to note.
If you want to cancel us for anything we've said, please do so at operaboxscore.com.
Write an open letter.
Well, speaking of cancellations, at the press event for Lyric's season announcement, there was a long question, wasn't really a question, asked during the Q&A session about what's going on with the David Pountney ring cycle that never finished due to the pandemic. They were just about to stage Götterdämmerung, and then March 2020 happened. And so Anthony Freud, who was like leaving, was like, well,
it's not my problem anymore.
Basically, yeah. But it's true that like Wagner is expensive, and Elijah is not an opera. So as epic as it is, it's actually almost as long as Götterdämmerung, but it's just not an opera.
And it feels even longer.
Virginia Opera doing Don Giovanni, which I'm okay with because, as you all know, it won the OBS Best Act of a Mozart Opera Award. Wasn't that an award?
It won Best Opera in our bracket.
Mozart bracket?
A while ago.
Okay.
Yeah, we need to do the Wagner bracket next.
I think it won Best Overall Opera.
That's true.
Oh, of all time.
From the
You're
World
right,
Cup
yeah.
a couple of years ago. No, Best Mozart Act was Marriage of Figaro. I mean, as someone who defended both Don Giovanni in that first bracket and Marriage of Figaro, this is just like the reigning championship coming back to set the record straight. Then I'll be gone for 6 more months.
Finally, I just want to say that Vittorio Grigolo does himself no favors by taking contracts in Russia. He's already been canceled for, you know, groping a chorister. I forget what that was exactly.
Yeah, that sounds about
he got fired.
Right.
And now that he's like persona non grata in the West, he's like, okay, well, I guess I'm big in Russia now.
Well, his next comeback is going to be in Norman Lebrecht's production of Turandot.
What about, before we go to Good Call, Bad Call, anybody have any opinions about the Oscars In Memoriam segment?
Oh, God.
Which I think it's hilarious that Andrea Bocelli has replaced Sarah Brightman with his own son for that duet.
His own son is pretty good looking, I have to say. But I was really annoyed about that, actually, because the In Memoriam clips are usually my favorite.
It was very distracting.
Yeah, and like you couldn't see what was on the screen because they were like giving you the full stage experience and not like what was on that screen. So
yeah, I also don't know that I need dancers during it, the In Memoriam segment.
It's a shade too artsy. I'm still mad that Poor Things didn't win Best Score because you know me, I love my weird bleeps and bloops. Let's wrap this show up.
Good call, bad call on Opera Box Score.
Good call, bad call. That is how we end the show here on Opera Box Score. Let's start today with Oliver Camacho.
Earlier today, it was announced that Glyndebourne has added an additional performance of their sold-out run of Giulio Cesare. That's good news. That's growth. Yeah. And that production features Louise Alder and friend of the show, Arya Nussbaum-Cohen.
Matt Cummings.
I'm here to update all of our listeners who are wondering whether or not I am still a stan of Dame Jane Glover, and I can say, don't worry, I am. The experience of getting to sing St. John Passion under her baton hands, it was just remarkable. She is such an incredible musician and such a giving collaborator. Like, it was a really, really wonderful experience, and if you're ever in a city where she is performing, you should not miss the opportunity to see her.
I have a very good call, which is incredibly on brand for us. So there is an Italian rugby team that won the Six Nations tournament, and their final game was against France. They won 23-20, and they decided to celebrate in the best possible way by all of these untrained singers, I think we can generously say, sitting together in the locker room, belting out Nessun Dorma. Let's take a little listen. Nailed it. That's it for this week's edition of America's Talk Radio Show About Opera. Make sure you subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Get your voice heard and find links to stuff we've talked about at our website, operaboxscore.com. That's also where you can put your money where our mouths are. Give back to the OBS using the Support the Team tab. Your announcer is Norm Waddell. Your creative consultant is Oliver Camacho. And your audio editor is me. For co-host Matt Cummings and our guest Sylvia McNair, I'm Weston Williams asking you to continue the conversation about opera as you correlate opera with a completely normal biological function. We're back with an all-new show next week when we go inside the huddle with Hera Haseng Park. Plus, you get more opera headlines, more hot takes, and more financially responsible oratorios. Join us.